journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, July 24th, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
Silence is not an option.
Puerto Rico's highly organized teachers face violent repression in their struggle for labor rights and quality education. The LA City Council agrees on an historic plastic bag ban, and a look at the federal minimum wage increase going into effect today. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. The Los Angeles City Council voted on Tuesday to ban the use of all plastic bags in the city's retail and grocery stores by 2010. According to the unanimous decision, the ban will go into effect if the state fails to impose a minimum 25 cent per use fee for consumers requesting plastic bags. More immediately, the City Council also approved a ban on food service products using styrofoam for packaging from city events and facilities starting next year. The recent steps taken by the City Council were hailed by environmental groups as crucial to the future of the city's environment and economy. As the second largest city in the United States, LA's population uses an estimated 2.3 billion non-biodegradable plastic bags per year. With the impending ban in place, city officials are hoping to reduce the figure by 30% before 2010. Anticipating these types of regulation, a coalition called Save the Plastic Bag, representing the plastic bag industry, criticized the move as based on misinformation about their product. Joining me in studio this morning is Kirsten James. She's the water quality director with the group Heal the Bay. Welcome to Uprising.
Good morning.
Good morning. First, explain the detrimental effects that plastic bag use has had in the city itself before this, you know, ban takes effect.
Right. Well, obviously, from Heal the Bay's perspective, we look at the marine environment. And plastics, such as plastic bags, are some of the most prevalent forms of marine debris that we're finding on our beaches and in the oceans. And what happens is these bags, as you know, don't biodegrade. So they stay in the ocean forever, basically, and they continue to impact our marine life. Sea turtles have been shown to ingest these items, sea birds, and it causes starvation and then death of these animals.
So has plastic bag use, you know, just through the campaigns that we've seen encouraging people to buy canvas totes, et cetera, has plastic bag use shown to be decreasing on its own, even without the city council vote?
You know, there's 6 billion bags in L.A., so I think, you know, education can make progress at having people to bring reusable bags. Heal the Bay did a day without a bag back in December, where we distributed over 10,000 bags in conjunction with the city and the county. And
these
different
are reusable canvas bags.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, I see more people bringing reusable bags to the supermarkets. But unfortunately, with 6 billion bags out there each year, you know, we need to do more. And that's what the city action does.
I remember almost more than 10 years ago visiting a friend in Germany and being surprised at the grocery store that if you wanted to get a plastic bag, you had to pay a little extra. And most people, of course, brought their own bags. And that was more than 10 years ago in a European city. I think we're a little bit behind the times here in the U.S.
Yeah, I definitely agree. We're behind the curve. I myself just got back from Italy a few weeks ago, and there as well, they're charging per bag, and I saw a lot fewer plastic bags leaving the supermarket. So, you know, other countries such as China have banned plastic bags, and, you know, here we are, the United States, and, you know, we're doing little to nothing. And so, you know, the city of L.A. really on Tuesday showed that, you know, the citizens care about this issue and our council members care, and we need to take action.
Kirsten, let's talk about what culminated in this vote. I mean, you know, a lot of news coverage starts with how officials act, but very little news coverage goes to who prompted politicians to act, the activist, you know, struggle behind it. Explain to our listeners what your organization has been doing, how long you've been doing it.
Yeah, for almost 2 years, Heal the Bay has been waging a larger campaign against plastics in the environment because it is so detrimental and it is such an urban blight. So as this larger campaign last year, we helped, we were sponsors of AB 258, which was a bill that required specific best management practices for plastic manufacturing facilities that use the raw material we call nurdles. So these nurdles mimic fish eggs in the environment, and they make their way to the water bodies and cause real problems in the aquatic environment. So that was a first step. This year, we're also sponsoring two bills, one that is SB 899, which covers derelict fishing gear, which is basically plastic fishing gear that gets lost in the marine environment and continues to wreak havoc and capture fish and other marine life. And then we're also looking at the statewide level for a plastic bag initiative, which is AB 2058. And what this bill would do is it would look towards a reduction target of 70% in bags over the next few years.
For the entire state, not just
correct,
the city of LA.
Correct, correct. And if this target is not met, then stores would be required to institute a per-bag fee of 25 cents. Or more.
So just like what the city council approved. And of course, when California takes a stand like this, the rest of the country is often fairly quick to follow. So your organization, what specifically did you do to get the city council to consider this issue and bring a motion to the city council on Tuesday?
Mm-hmm. Well, over the last year, we've been working with city council offices, attending different council meetings and really voicing our opinion of how big this issue is. We also waged a petition campaign over Earth Month and urged the city to take action on plastic bags. We got thousands of signatures from citizens for that effort. And so we really advocated with the council offices to make this happen. And I think, you know, from the unanimous vote, we really see that the council members listened, they heard, and there were some definite champions on the council on Tuesday, which was great.
Such as?
Councilmember Smith was great. We saw some great friendly amendments by Councilmember Alarcon. Mm-hmm. Of course, Reyes was the council member who brought this motion to the floor, and there were many others, too. It was just a really great day to see that unanimous support for this.
So let's exactly understand, make sure we understand what was passed. So if the state as a whole does not impose a minimum 25 cent per use fee for consumers, meaning if in 2 years the state does not require stores to charge customers 25 cents per bag, then all bags will be completely banned.
That's correct. Plastic bags would be banned at that point. So this fits very nicely with the statewide legislation we're working on, AB 2058, because that would institute a 25-cent fee. So if that does go into place, then that would be what the city of LA obviously does. But if it doesn't, and if it would not pass this session or in the next year, then the ban would go into effect. And the neat thing about this action by the city council is they're also looking at both paper bags and biodegradable bags, mm-hmm. because as you know, those are also have their own environmental consequences. So it's important not just to look at this in a silo and just address plastic bags, but to also look at all single-use plastic or carry-out bags.
My guest is Kirsten James. She's the water quality director at Heal the Bay, a local environmental organization that has been instrumental in bringing the vote to the city council this past Tuesday. A unanimous decision resulted to ban the use of all plastic bags if the state fails to impose a 25 cent per use fee for customers requesting bags. So let's talk very briefly then about these, as you said, paper bags or biodegradable bags, because that, you know, a lot of times when you you go to the store and they ask you paper or plastic, people might feel like they're, hey, I'm doing the conscious thing by choosing paper over plastic, and that's biodegradable. But what's the problem with that?
Yeah, it's a more complicated issue than you would think. You know, paper bags have their own environmental consequences.
You need trees to make them.
Exactly. You need natural resources. You know, the production of paper bags takes emits a lot of greenhouse gases. So, you know, at Heal the Bay, obviously, we're looking at the marine impacts primarily, which with the plastic bags are the worst offenders. But we don't want to ignore the other carry-out items, too, because obviously they have their own consequences. Mm-hmm. And then the interesting thing is that a lot of people say, oh, well, now there's new biodegradable bags that are coming out, you know, your PLAs, as they're called. And what we find is that those really don't have any difference in the marine environment. They act very much like plastic bags.
So they may biodegrade in the soil, but not in water.
Exactly. So from a waste management perspective, they might be a nice choice. But from the marine environment perspective, they really don't have a difference. So it's really important that, you know, any municipal or statewide action on this really consider all forms of carry-out bags.
What about recycling? I mean, what about people who say, well, what if I just put all my plastic bags into the recycling unit or find the plastic bag recycling bins that you can find at Ralph's, et cetera?
Yeah, well, recycling, we find, is just not the answer to this problem. You know, like I said, there's 6 billion bags in L.A. County, and less than 5% of those are actually recycled. So, you know, it's not going to get us to where we need to be.
Plus, recycling, of course, needs energy, which also can act as greenhouse gas emissions.
Exactly.
Well.
So it has its own environmental consequences.
Mm. So let's talk about other cities where this has happened. I understand Malibu and Manhattan Beach already have similar bans.
Yeah, a lot of local communities are really finding that, you know, from an economic standpoint and an environmental standpoint, they really need to take action, especially those communities which rely so heavily on tourism. They're finding that, you know, if their bags are littered with different types of debris and plastics, no one's going to come to those areas for vacation. So they're seeing the economic,
mm-hmm.
yeah, they're seeing the economic consequences too. So, you know, they're looking at it from an environmental and economic standpoint, and they're taking action. So we've seen recently, like you said, Manhattan Beach a few weeks ago, Malibu a few weeks before that, and there's just cities popping up all over that are considering this. Obviously, up in the Bay Area, San Francisco took action, was one of the first to take action, and we see a lot of others following.
Mm. And what about other states in the United States? Do you see this sort of as a national trend?
Yeah, I do. I think definitely California is the leader so far, but you know, we get calls once in a while from other communities. For example, someone called me from Virginia, then they're looking to wage their own campaign on plastic bags. Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I know some East Coast cities are also considering it. Mm. So, you know, it is a trend nationwide.
Kirsten, how is the business community responding, particularly retail and grocery stores?
I mean, there's definitely mixed reviews on that. You know, you see retailers like Whole Foods and IKEA that are taking the charge. IKEA is charging for their plastic bags.
They already charge
yes.
for, yeah.
Yeah, and Whole Foods has gone away from plastic bags entirely. So, you know, there's a mixed response, but, you know, retailers are sort of looking at this because plastic bags cost them a lot less to provide, but they don't want just a switch to paper because those are more expensive.
So, in fact, a plastic a bag ban that includes plastic but also addresses paper could perhaps financially benefit some of these businesses.
Correct. And what consumers need to understand is that the prices of these bags are incorporated in the prices of their food. So there really is no free bag. So, you know, we often hear the argument that, oh, well, you know, I use these bags to line my trash can or, you know, to pick up after my dog. But they have to understand those aren't free bags. Those are bags that are, you know, paid for by the grocery stores and are incorporated in the food prices. So, and often enough, most people don't reuse the bag, so that's really not a valid argument.
And you can certainly find other ways to address your animal's waste products.
Exactly.
That's not a good enough reason to contaminate
right.
the environment. Kirsten, what about this Save the Plastic Bag Coalition? I found a lot of quotes from their representatives in news articles. I had a hard time finding their website. website. What is this coalition, and what is their argument?
You know, this is a group that I think has recently cropped up in this debate. I really don't give much credence to any of their arguments. You know, I've heard them say things like, oh, we question the actual impact to marine animals, et cetera. And, you know, scientifically, we see the evidence out there. I talked to a head turtle researcher last week, and he was telling me stories about being out in the field and having to pull plastic bags out of the mouth and other places in the turtle. And so, you know, it's a reality. These plastic bags are impacting our marine environment. So I don't really give much credence to anything they would say.
And they, I understand, represent the plastic bag industry, which is, of course, the industry that would be the most impacted most directly by this ban.
Yeah, I don't know their exact tie, but I think they definitely are partners.
Well, Kirsten, James, where can listeners find out more about the statewide effort that you mentioned? And also, just on a very brief note, the issue about canvas tote bags. I mean, those are pretty inexpensive these days. You can buy a canvas tote bag for, what, $2 or $3?
Yeah, or less than that. I see them at Vons for 99 cents. Mm. So, you know, you can find more about this effort and others, our bill, AB 2058, on our website, www.healthebay.org. And definitely, you know, call your local senators and assembly members and urge them to support this bill. It's going to be coming up to the floor by the end of August, and we really need the community support behind this.
That's healthebay.org. Kirsten James is the water quality director at the organization Heal the Bay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You are listening to Uprising, and later in the hour, we will take a look at the federal minimum wage increase that goes into effect today. Holly Sklar will be our guest, and before that, we'll hear from three leaders from the Federation of Teachers in Puerto Rico who are very, very organized and very upset about their labor conditions. Today, we're going to be playing the Black Agenda report instead of the usual Friday airing, because instead of Uprising, KPFK will air tomorrow an important House Judiciary Committee hearing entitled Executive Power and Its Constitutional Limitations. So we won't be on the air tomorrow, but we'll be back live on Monday. So stay tuned for the Black Agenda report. Glenn Ford is a writer and radio commentator and the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. This week's commentary is about Afghanistan.
The United States has a long history of wiping out wedding parties in Afghanistan and Iraq. The latest atrocity killed 49 guests at a wedding festivity, 39 of them women and children, according to an Afghan government investigation. While the Americans initially insisted that only male militants were killed in the bombing raid. This is the usual story. Despite all its smart weapons, the U.S. periodically wipes out most of at least two extended families gathered for matrimonial celebration in occupied countries. One can only conclude that wedding parties are tempting targets, what with the music playing, the bright and colorful ceremonial clothing, the dancing, the singing. What brave American pilot could resist locking on to such an attractive bullseye? There could hardly be a less threatening event than a wedding party, which is why it's so important to note every time the Americans blow one up. The crime, mass murder from the air, points up the casually racist nature of the U.S. occupations of both Afghanistan and Iraq. These homicides, these acts of depraved indifference to human life, reveal the occupiers' true attitude towards the native, that they are like roaches to be squashed on sight. In the case of the latest wedding party massacre, a high-level official in the American-imposed Afghan regime reported that the families had nothing to do with the Taliban. But what if they did? Would it be all right for the Americans to burn and obliterate families whose members are sympathetic to the Taliban? No, that would be a crime against humanity under international law. Yet the U.S. occupiers murder civilians with abandon every day in Iraq and Afghanistan, where they are cloaked in immunity, not by law, because nothing can immunize soldiers against war crimes and crimes against humanity, but by American brute force. In Baghdad, American soldiers and mercenaries think nothing of shooting their way out of traffic jams that naturally occur in a city larger than Chicago. The penalty for getting too close to an American vehicle as one commutes to and from one's job in Baghdad is death. And of course, all deaths at the hands of the Americans are justifiable. This is the nature of occupation, especially when the occupier comes from a racist country. By official count, hundreds of civilians have been killed in Afghanistan this year. The real number is certainly much higher, since the Americans, to put it bluntly, routinely lie about their crimes. The body count has become an extreme embarrassment to puppet President Hamid Karzai, who is helpless to do anything about it. Meanwhile, the Americans do what they do best, make enemies. They accomplish this without effort because they arrive in the country pre-programmed to treat the natives like vermin. The United States is proud that it makes the smartest bombs in the world. Then it behaves like a nation of dumb racist murderers and wonders why people hate the name America. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
For more information, visit www.blackagendareport.com. Welcome back to Uprising. The highly organized teachers of Puerto Rico have faced violent repression in their fight for labor rights and quality education. The Federación de Maestros de Puerto Rico, or FMPR, represents over 40,000 teachers and is the largest independent union in Puerto Rico. In February of 2008, teachers voted to strike after working without a contract for 30 months. Their historic 10-day strike was met with police action and over a dozen arrests. The FMPR's main opposition is Governor Aníbal Acevedo Vila, whose government decertified the union in retaliation. Now, leaders of the FMPR are on a national tour of the United States, and they're coming through Los Angeles. Their aim is to, quote, build solidarity with teachers and communities about what it will take to win quality education for all students, as well as build a truly progressive labor movement. They're going to be at a fundraiser this evening at UTLA 3303 Wilshire Boulevard, room 815, and we'll repeat that information. But I want to introduce now my three guests who are three leaders in the FMPR. Rafael Feliciano Hernandez is the president of FMPR. Welcome.
Hi, saludos a todos.
Thank you very much for joining us. And also with us, Luis Santiago is an executive board member of FMPR. Ana Serrano is the vice president of the Aguadilla local at FMPR. Welcome, Ana and Luis.
Good morning, and thank you for this space.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for joining us. It's definitely an honor to have you three here representing such a big labor movement in Puerto Rico. First, let's talk about the 10-day strike that took place in February. Why was it historic, and what was the result of the strike? What was the outcome, Rafael?
Well, we developed a 10-day strike in last February. It's very important, and it's a historical process because between 23 to 26,000 of teachers go to the strike. Most of them were women, were teachers of the elementary level, and I think that is a very important process for us in Puerto Rico. You know that we are a colony of U.S. No Child Left Behind is also in Puerto Rico, making a big damage to our educational system. And the community, the teachers, make a joint effort against the government and the intention of the government to privatize schools using charter schools and so things, cosas como esa. We stop that. We make an agreement to stop a charter school in Puerto Rico. In Puerto Rico, they cannot develop charter school actually. And also we gain the respect of the community and of the people of Puerto Rico. And we fight not only for our teachers' issues, also we fight for a good education for all the our people in Puerto Rico because we have very bad condition in our schools.
Let's talk first about the conditions of the teachers. In terms of salary, for example, what were teachers earning before the strike? How severe were your working conditions? And did things improve after the strike, Anna?
During the past 12 years, there hadn't been an increase to the basic salary of teachers in Puerto Rico. Before the strike, we were earning $1,500. With the threat of the strike alone, just the threat, there was a $100 increase granted to the base salary pay. And as part of the negotiations to end the strike, there was an additional $150. So right now in Puerto Rico, teachers are earning at the beginning level $1,750.
A month.
Yes, that's a monthly salary. Teachers that, for instance, have longer time in the system, perhaps like 10, 15 years, are up to about $2,400 per month. And in terms of working conditions in Puerto Rico, one of the problems that we've had is that the Department of Education has deviated funds from the school to utilize for technological, what they call technological advances, money that was destined for books, for teaching materials, for, you know, the
chalkboard,
mm-hmm. the dry erase paper, toilet paper, mm-hmm. you name it. That money was deferred for the use of other systems. For instance, we have a punch system, a biometric time measurement system in Puerto Rico, which we are also fighting. So, you know, money has been taken from the schools and it has been placed in systems that have nothing to do with the educational process and, in fact, detract from the educational process, like that biometric system.
Meaning that people have to
We have to put our fingerprint yes,
to time in and
order,
out,
yes,
to punch in and out.
Yes, it's a time device system that we are fighting in the courts, and we also have a group of teachers that have been resisting using this system, and we're having a battle right now. Mm-hmm. Teachers are not being paid in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the class size condition, this was one of the reasons that we went on strike and that there was so much support.
What is the class size?
There are groups that have up to 40, 42, 43, 44. My sister taught a school, a 10th grade class with 47 students. It's impossible to educate with so many students, and that's one of the principal reasons that we went on strike and were supported by so many members of the community.
Now, the government decertified your union in retaliation for voting to strike. Was that legal? How has it affected your ability to carry out your tasks, Luis?
Okay. Under Law 45, that's the labor law in Puerto Rico, the government could say that it's correct, no? But nothing stopped the teachers, no? The union does not come from a law. The union does not come from a paper. The union comes from the will of the people.
So
no?
The governor can just, as a single person, can just decertify an entire labor organization.
Okay, the law is so bad that in our case, before we went to the strike, just voting for the strike, mm-hmm. they could decertify you. No, that's not what the government could do. But nothing stopped us. The penalties did not stop us. The decertification did not stop us. The rompehuelgas, like we call them, did not stop us. The scabs. We went on to strike because the will of the teachers, the will of the workers, cannot be stopped by a law.
How has that affected your ability to carry out your union task, Rafael?
Well, first of all, for us, the right to strike is a worker's right. Any law can the law can say that we don't have that right, but we have that right because we are not a slave, and we have the right to stop to work when we understand that we have it. The government make the decertification because they want to shut down our dues. And that was very difficult because the union was works for many months without any dues. The leadership don't have salary. And most of the work of the union was in a voluntary basis. That is very difficult, but it's very important, and that is one of the things that we will share tonight, is that money is not the principal factor to develop a strike. It's the voluntad, how you say?
The will
of the people, mm-hmm. the compromise of the people and the community to fight for better labor condition, but also for a better educational condition for our students.
I want to remind our listeners, my guests are Rafael Feliciano Hernandez, the president of FMPR, the teachers union in Puerto Rico, also Luis Santiago, executive board member, and Ana Serrano, the vice president of the Aguadilla local of FMPR. And they are going to be at an event tonight, addressing an event organized by United Teachers of Los Angeles, UTLA, at 7 p.m. at 3303 Wilshire Boulevard. That's the UTLA building. It's at room 815. And for more information, you can call 213-309-2713. That's 213-309-2713. It's this evening at 7 p.m. at the UTLA building. All three of my guests will be there. So let's talk a little bit about some of the other factors at play in the union or around the union in Puerto Rico, which is that I understand that the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, has aligned with the governor of Puerto Rico, the person who decertified your union, and is planning on working to replace the FMPR with another union. Is this true? And if so, why would the SEIU do this?
Yes. Well, when we were in the strike, we were making negotiation for the new contract, and
this is after working without a contract for 30 months.
Exactly. Okay. In that moment, SEIU intervention was very bad because SEIU supports the actual governor of Puerto Rico, Aníbal Acevedo Vilá, and they developed fundraisings for the reelection campaign of the governor. In that moment, Dennis Rivera fly from New York to Puerto Rico and meets with the governor and said that he cannot make a new contract with Puerto with Federación because they want to make a union busting against Federación, and if he make a new contract, he will not give the money for the reelection campaign. He have a compromise of $4 million for that campaign. Mm-hmm. That was terrible. But I want to say a little detail. We have to make a distinction between the leadership of SEIU and the members of SEIU. For example, in the convention,
Was held in Puerto Rico,
exactly.
The SEIU convention.
We went to the convention center and we have to fight with the police and with the SWAT teams of the police in Puerto Rico to be in the front of the building of the convention to give flyers to the stewards of the SEIU. The governor make that order, and we have some of the teachers were beaten by the police and the special forces of the police. In the convention, most of the stewards of SEIU supports Federación, and they say that is a shame what is doing the national leadership with the teachers in Puerto Rico. I think that we have to develop and to support the movement inside SEIU for more democracy and for the empowerment of the workers of his own union. But in our strike, the intervention of the SEIU was terrible.
So FMPR is working with this sort of a dissident movement within SEIU to try to reform the union, make it more democratic, etc. You're working with that movement?
Well, we have a communication with some of the leadership, and what we do is to support the movement for a real democracy and for the real empowerment for any union. But in this case, for the SEIU movement that is fighting back to change the form of what the leadership is managing.
And
leadership.
Is this because this is essentially FMPR is an independent union?
Well, I think that part of the reason why we're doing this is because our union has a very long tradition of participatory democracy, where a union with rank and file makes the decisions, and the leadership basically is the vehicle which carries out the will of the teachers. And all of the leadership is elected. Our leadership comes from the classroom. We have within our constitution articles which do not permit limitation of terms. So all of our leaders have to constantly go back to work in the classrooms, and we don't have people that are encrusted in leadership and at that tradition.
So sort of career unionists.
My salary is the same salary that I have in the classroom.
Right.
You're not paid huge amounts.
No, yeah, all of our leadership maintains the salary of teachers. That's part of the commitment of the union to maintain rank and file as leaders, because we don't have a different class of leadership. Our leaders come from us. Mm. We're teachers, social workers, librarians that come into leadership of the union, and we go back to our posts within the schools and develop new leadership. And that kind of tradition is what has allowed our union leadership to maintain such a bond, because we're teachers and we're leaders, but we are the union. We are the union.
Why are you touring the U.S. mainland, and what sort of solidarity do you see from teachers here, you know, across the country, Luis?
The situation of the Puerto Rican teachers is similar as the situation of the teachers here in the United States. For example, Rafael mentioned a little while ago, No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind is used to privatize, you know, the education here and in Puerto Rico. And it's important that we have communication, that our experience, you know, can be communicated to the teachers in the United States. But it's also important that we hear from them and see what is their experience. And it's important that they know what is the SEIU doing in Puerto Rico that supports a bus union, that is the Asociación de Maestros, that's the one that wants to challenge the Federación de Maestros. And also, it's important that in the, if they can also help us to fertilize our union, and let's be real honest, we're also in fundraising, no? Because the fundraising is necessary in this moment that the government has used everything against us. And
so you're really hurting for dues, and as you said, salaries even of your leadership.
Remember, we developed a very hard strike. We need a time for a recovery. And the government make an alliance with some leaders of the SAU to make a joint efforts against Federación and against the teachers. That is it's a shame for the labor movement.
Are you
hearing
from rank and file SEIU members?
Yes, we have contact with some leaders of the opposition sectors, and also we have a good relation with the rank and file members of SEIU in Puerto Rico, because many times Federación support SIU in Puerto Rico, and we marched with SIU. For us, was a very bad surprise to see how Dennis Rivera make an intervention directly against the teachers that we were in a strike. But I think that in this moment, what needs the Federation? Well, first of all, we need to share the information to break the isolation between the fights of the teachers in many places in the U.S. And it's very important to share the information. What happens in Puerto Rico? We will develop part of this tonight. But also, we need some economical support, because we, in this moment, we are in the process of the recovery. And we need to develop a campaign to affiliate new members to recover the dues that we have it before the strike.
And where can listeners can certainly come to tonight's event in terms of that financial solidarity as well, but is there a website or any other way that listeners can express solidarity?
Yes, we have a website, www.fmprlucha.org.
org.
FMPRLucha.org.
Yes.
FMPR, which stands for Federación de Maestros de Puerto Rico, the Teachers Federation in Puerto Rico. And my guests have been Rafael Feliciano Hernandez, the president of the union, Luis Santiago, executive board member of the union, and Ana Serrano, vice president of the Aguadilla local at FMPR. I want to thank the three of you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
For me, it's an honor to be here.
Yes, absolutely, for me to have you here as well. And good luck to you and your struggle. Also, again, a reminder, the event tonight is at 7 p.m. at the UTLA building, 3303 Wilshire Boulevard, room 815. For more information about the event, you can call 213-309-2713. And the website, again, is fmprlucha.org. We'll link to that from our website later today. You are listening to Uprising, and after this short break, we'll take a look at the recent increase in the federal minimum wage. Is it too little, too late? Stay tuned.
Hola, this is Hector Elizondo. Sunday evening, July 27th, KPFK will kick off its 50th anniversary at the Ford Amphitheater. KPFK, that's my station and yours, with a history and track record unmatched in radio, and is powered by the people. My fellow artists and political satirist Culture Clash are headlining the evening, along with KPFK's own Pocho Hour of Power, led by Lalo Alcaraz, creator of the daily comic strip La Cucaracha, and the sizzling music of Mezcla. The performing artists are donating their talent to benefit KPFK Pacifica Radio, an evening of cutting-edge comedy and music under the stars. That's the Ford Amphitheater this Sunday night at 8 p.m. For tickets, please call 323-461-3673 or visit kpfk.org. Reservations for pre-show celebrity reception, please call 818-985-2711, extension 214. Nos vemos, chividiamo.
Welcome back to Uprising. The federal minimum wage is set to increase 70 cents today, bringing the mandated hourly pay rate across the country to a whopping $6.55 per hour. Today's minimum wage raise is the second of three annual increases set forth by Congress after a decade of no such action. With the U.S. economy in a fragile state, diverging views are emerging over the pay raise. The Employment Policy Institute released data that they say shows a wage increase will now cause job losses for vulnerable groups, such as teenagers and adults without a high school diploma. But the UC Berkeley Labor Center released new research that refuted such claims. They state that their findings show beneficial wage increases for the lowest paid workers have no such negative effects on employment. Nevertheless, a 70-cent wage increase may be too little too late when factored in with the cost of living expenses. The current $6.55 hourly wage is still lower than in 1997 and significantly lower than in 1968 in terms of purchasing power. Let Justice Roll, a Faith and Community Voices campaign, is calling for a $10 per hour living wage by 2010. They contend that when the third scheduled minimum wage increase takes place in 2009, the federal hourly pay of $7.25 an hour will still be insufficient to have adequate living standards. My guest is Holly Sklar. She is the co-author of the report, A Just Minimum Wage, Good for Workers, Business and Our Future, and the book, Raise the Floor, Wages and Policies That Work for All of Us. Welcome to Uprising, Holly.
Great to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, let's talk about these supposed diverging views on the effects of raising the minimum wage from a paltry amount to a slightly less paltry amount, and how supposedly that's going to make it worse for workers in terms of job loss. Where do you stand on that?
Well, first of all, it's really good to know that the Employment Policies Institute was set up as a way to kind of pretend to be a research group that was nonpartisan, but it's really a kind of flacking for the National Restaurant Association and the restaurant industry, a lot of lobbyists connected to it. I had the pleasure some years ago, of debating the head of it, Rick Berman. And, you know, one of the things that's really interesting about the Employment Policies Institute, and a lot of folks are against raising the minimum wage, is there's this catch-22 that they offer. There's nothing new about it. Basically, here's their position. You can't, when it's good times, they say you can't raise the minimum wage because it's going to hurt us. It's going to hurt the economy. You can't do it. When it's bad times, they say you can't raise the minimum wage because it'll hurt the bad economy. So basically, they're just always twisting around the information and the argument whenever they can so that you can never have to raise the minimum wage. Their position is essentially the same as it's been for years, and it was put really beautifully by Murray Weidenbaum when he was the with the Council of Economic Advisors under the Reagan administration. He said, look, if we had our druthers, we would have killed the minimum wage, right? We would kill it, but we can't do that. So what we try and do is basically let the cost of living rise and kill it through inflation. And so between 1997 and 2007, we went through this long period, decade-long, it was the longest period in history without a rise in the minimum wage, in part because groups like Employment Policies Institute and others put out all this kind of junk research about that it was going to hurt the economy. But as you say, University of California, the Fiscal Policy Institute in New York, all sorts of groups have really studied this carefully with a lot more reliable research that shows those arguments are bunk.
Now, you know, Holly, when times are bad, you hear from the president who wants to win goodwill that we're going to get these tax rebates, as we recently did, and that's going to stimulate the economy. How is it that their logic to give people more money and having that stimulate the economy works for this sort of one-time tax rebate thing, but then if you just raise people's minimum wage, somehow that's not going to work?
There's no logic, of course, but they're not big on logic. I mean, there's nothing more perfect of an economic stimulus than getting money right into the hands of people who really need it the most. And the people who need it the most are the ones who then go right out and spend it on necessities at their local businesses. So they're buying food, gas, health care, other necessities that they need right then. Whereas, why do you want to give out a rebate to everybody is so that you can, you know, in part get away with something. You have to do something politically in these circumstances. But it's basically another way to put more money that's not needed in the hands of the people who don't need it. I mean, the top 1%, richest 1% in the country have just been handed, you know, billions and billions and billions of dollars in tax cuts, and it's part of the same. It's shoveling money up from the bottom and the middle all the way up to the top. Whereas a minimum wage raise increase is going right to the bottom, lifting the bottom, which is totally what we need to do, is strengthen this economy, strengthen it from the bottom up, because our economy is being built on a house of cards right now. The things that people were doing to cover up the fact that they didn't have enough money, not cover it up in a bad way, but get by, right? Going into tremendous debt, maxing out work hours. You know, everybody's working as many hours as they can. And then maxing out credit cards, trying to get money out of their home if they have a home equity, to try and make up for the fact that their real wages are falling, adjusted for inflation. Well, now you've got a situation where it's not sustainable. You can't have an economy built on rising debt and falling wages. It's not possible.
Now, the minimum wage being indexed possibly to cost of living increases, that would be sort of the last thing that the business industry wants, and those in government who would like to just do away altogether with the minimum wage. But I understand that presidential candidate Barack Obama is proposing such an initiative.
He is, and some other folks are as well. And our position at the Let Justice Roll Living Wage campaign is that indexing can make a lot of sense at the state level and at the citywide level. I mean, in California, for example, you've got an $8 minimum wage. It's not indexed. But in San Francisco, there's an inflation-adjusted citywide minimum wage, for example, within the state of California.
And so, that's because the cost of living varies city by city.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so when you get to the federal level, our position is that we should not index the next time around. If you let me explain that a little
sure.
bit. That is, what we really need to do is raise the minimum wage at the federal level in a bigger next step, because we've been in this situation where workers have taken many steps backward for every step forward, you know, little steps forward, big steps backward. So what we're calling for is a $10 minimum wage in the year 2010. And that's at a faster pace than some other folks who are calling for like $9.50 in 2011. So we think we got to get to 10 in 2010. $10, just to put that in perspective, the 1968 minimum wage, if you adjust for inflation, would have a buying power today of $9.86, right? So just getting to 10 in 2010 gets us around back to where we were in 1968. But the minimum wage is not scheduled federally to go up until to $7.25 until 2009. So we think it is necessary but also doable to go from the $7.25 in 2009, because that was too little too late, to take a next bigger step to 10 in 2010. And then what we want to do is then from there really adjust the minimum wage the way it needs to be to a minimum living standard. It's got to be enough for people to live on. We don't want to adjust for inflation until we get to that place where it's truly something people can live on. And the reason is this, because the cost of living rising, if you get adjusted for that, it's definitely better than falling backwards, which is why it's been really valuable at the state and local level while things haven't moved up, right? It prevents you from going backwards, but it doesn't move you forward. It just keeps you where you are. So if it's a sub, in other words, if it's a poverty wage, when you adjust it for inflation, it'll still be a poverty wage. You'll still always be making choices between health care, child care, food, you know, heating your home, putting gas in your car, whatever it is, right? You're still going to be making those choices. We want to raise it and then talk about making sure that it keeps up with the rising cost of living. And not only that, but the rise in economic progress. You don't want to just always be kind of standing still, you know, where you were, but moving forward, because you know, the economy's grown a lot and wages used to rise with rising worker productivity. You know, between 1947 and 1973, worker productivity rose 104%, and the minimum wage rose 101%. Testing for inflation, we had a growing middle class. Between 1973 and 2007, productivity went up 83%, but the minimum wage fell 22%.
Fell 22%.
Wow. And average worker wages in that period fell 10%. And at the same time, where did the money go? It went into profits, the owners, the CEOs. Domestic corporate profits in that same period shot up 219%. And in the industry, the retail industry, where it's disproportionately low-wage, minimum-wage workers, their profits went up even higher, 346%. So we want workers to be able to share in the rise in economic growth that they are so fundamental to producing, and not just in essentially in a position where they're not moving backward, right? That's better than where we've been, right? You don't want people moving backward, but we really want them moving forward in real terms, not just keeping up with, oh, well, I'm going to, you know, be able to pay for the rising cost of gasoline, but I'm still not going to have enough for health care, for example, or child care.
Finally,
and
Holly,
so,
go ahead.
Just to finish the thought. Mm-hmm. So our position is great at the state level, because at the state level, what happens is if let's say you set a state level and then it rises with the cost of living while the federal isn't going anywhere, when the federal minimum wage then goes up, it catches everybody back up. You see what I'm saying? It because the higher level applies, if we get to 10 in 2010, right, with a federal minimum wage, that will raise a lot of these state minimum wages that, even though they were inflation adjusted, are not that high.
Mm, so it'll help them catch up.
Yeah.
Holly Sklar is my guest. She is the co-author of the report, Just Minimum Wage, Good for Workers, Business, and Our Future, and the book Raise the Floor, Wages and Policies that Work for All of Us. She's also the senior policy advisor for the Let Justice Roll Living Wage Campaign. Where has the time gone, Holly? Unfortunately, we are out of time, but where can listeners find out more about the Let Justice Roll Living Wage Campaign?
We would love people to check us out and join us at letjusticeroll.org. LetJusticeRoll.org.
That's LetJusticeRoll.org, and certainly listeners can get hooked into that campaign. Holly Sklar, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Holly Sklar is our guest, and we've been talking about the federal minimum wage that just increased today to a whopping $6.55 an hour. Let Justice Roll campaign says that's too little too late. For Sonali, subversive thought for the day, Franklin Delano Roosevelt once said, "No business which depends for existence on paying less than living wages to its workers has any right to continue in this country." That's Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Tamika Zoghi is our engineer. I will be back live on Monday. Tomorrow we're going to be airing a live judiciary hearing, a judiciary committee hearing about executive power. And you can hear an audio stream of today's show after 10 a.m. on our website, which is linked via kpfk.org. Our email address is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at PacificaRadioArchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope to see you Sunday, July 27th at the Ford Amphitheater for the KPFK benefit.